Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier- und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
If you write about the London music scene long enough, you'll eventually hear about the cursed karaoke song. At this stage, it's become part urban legend, part industry in-joke. The story goes that one of the city's first karaoke bars opened in Soho in the late 80s. Some people say it was used by a criminal gang to launder money. Others say it was a front for a demon-worshipping cult. I even heard one version where the owner had installed a haunted karaoke system from Japan. Less creative types say it was just dodgy wiring. The outcome is always the same though. The bar burned down to the ground in 1989, killing anyone unlucky enough to be there that night. The victims of the blaze were somehow marked by a curse and can never move on to the afterlife. So, the souls are doomed to drift from bar to bar, waiting for some unlucky punter to sing the last song played before everything went up in smoke. Strange things allegedly happen to the person afterwards. It starts off small, not sleeping, hearing strange noises, your typical horror movie staples. It gets progressively worse until the poor sod is so tormented that they take their own life. The thing is, people can never agree on which song is supposedly cursed. But someone always knows somebody who sang it, regardless of how tenuous the link is. The hapless singer is usually an ex-colleague's uncle or second cousin of a roommate from uni. I suppose that's what makes it such a good story. Ludicrous, but hard to completely debunk. I'd learned about the curse when I was writing for Noteworthy. The magazine had never made big waves, but it's always had a solid fan base since its founder, Jez Musgrove, was a legend in the indie circuit during the 90s. By the time he contacted me, I was quite happy to leave blogging behind to share my thoughts on Noteworthy's splashy website. The fact that I actually spent most of my days funneling marketing content and composing moronic tweets is slightly less thrilling. It was mid-December last year, and some bright spark insisted we do a pub crawl for our Christmas party. The night consisted of downing overpriced drinks in overpacked establishments before being buffeted along to the next location, finally ending up in some grungy after-hours pub. Now, get a group of drunk music writers together, and there's a good chance they'll talk about the cursed karaoke song. What normally follows is an exchange of wild theories leading to a heated discussion that ends with the drunkest person belting out a heartfelt rendition of a song they summarized as evil. That night was no different. There's a woman who works for Noteworthy by the name of Julie Connell, an old-timer from the glory days of print media. She's known for being spiky around the younger staff members, but I've always found her okay. It took me a while to see that she was reacting strangely to the conversation. Whereas everyone else either joked or chimed in with their own opinions, she became very still and visibly tense. No one else seemed to notice. I kept watching as she sat there, staring at a gin and tonic while Alistair Murray put forward an impassionate yet unconvincing case for Lady in Red. That was when she left to go outside, muttering something about needing a cigarette. I should have left her alone. Things would probably be different if I had. I shivered as I left the warmth of the pub, the cold biting through my thin winter coat. I'm not a regular smoker, so I asked Julie if I could bum a cigarette. She held out the packet and we stood there a while, smoking in silence. I watched as the wisps from my lit cigarette unfurled and dissipated in the darkness like little wraiths released onto the unsuspecting world. I'll admit, I'd had a few drinks on board by that stage, so I decided to ask her. "So, what do you think?" She looked puzzled, and I leaned in closer. "The cursed song. Any theories?" I waited for Julie to say something, but instead, she stared ahead, taking a pull on a cigarette. I watched as she seemed to debate what to do next. Eventually, she sighed and nodded her head. It was 11 years ago, but Alice had been having problems before that. Julie's younger sister had always been fragile, but she hadn't experienced any big setbacks since her early 20s. However, the unlucky trifecta of a redundancy, breakup, and mounting debt seemed to have gradually eroded her mental state. According to Julie, their upbringing had been grim, full of bad memories and a never-ending rotation of foster families. Even as adults, she'd always felt responsible for Alice, which was how she'd ended up as a permanent fixture on Julie's couch. They'd gone out the night it happened. Julie had dragged her sister to see an up-and-coming band at a pub in Croydon. It had been Alice's first night out in months, and she seemed to be enjoying herself. The band were fine, but not particularly memorable. As the audience began to disperse, a gaunt-looking man took to the stage to set up assorted pieces of equipment. He was very tall and wore an ill-fitting grey suit. A thin shriek echoed from the mic when he introduced himself as the MC and welcomed the now sparse crowd to karaoke night. Julie hadn't recalled seeing any posters or flyers for karaoke, but figured it may have been a semi-regular thing. As the MC scanned the crowd for volunteers, she felt a rush of air to her left as Alice's hand shot up. Alice had always been a good singer and could never resist the lure of a microphone. She downed a drink before trotting towards the MC. Julie noticed the cuffs of his white shirt were rimmed with black as he held out his hand and pulled Alice onto the stage. As Alice took the mic, Julie felt a focus begin to slip, like everything was blurred at the edges. It was July and the pub's AC was practically non-existent, so she decided to nip out for some air and a quick smoke. She briefly heard the opening bars to a familiar song as she stepped outside. Julie lit another cigarette, taking a long drag before exhaling slowly. I waited, not wanting to interrupt, as she appeared to be concentrating very hard. In the end, she just shook her head and continued. The stage was empty when Julie went back inside. As she cast a searching glance for Alice, she overheard a girl with henna-dyed hair tell a friend that there was a woman in the toilets who was in, quote, a right state. Julie found Alice sobbing hysterically in a pea-soaked cubicle. She was obviously terrified, but Julie couldn't make any sense of her incoherent babbling. She eventually managed to bundle Alice into a taxi before getting her home. Julie reckoned she'd had some sort of episode that she'd snap out of in a few days. But Alice got worse. A lot worse. In the weeks that followed, she became plagued by nightmares, and Julie often awoke to late-night fits or ear-splitting screams. Her hygiene began to suffer too. At first, it was subtle, like wearing the same thing for a few days or showering every other day. But as time wore on, Alice refused to bathe or change her clothes. Her hair became lank and greasy, and clusters of whiteheads sprouted around her nose and chin. Julie arranged appointments with doctors and therapists, but Alice refused to go, preferring to spend her days on the couch, staring listlessly at the endless sludge of bad daytime TV. And things had gone on like this, until the incident with the mirrors. Julie had come home from work to find Alice in the bathroom, tunelessly humming to herself as she coated the mirror in chalkboard paint that Julie had bought for a long-abandoned DIY project. Alice had done the same thing to the mirror in the bedroom, her progress charted by the black paint on the tiles and carpet. She'd even blotted out the mirrors on Julie's compacts and eyeshadow palettes. When she confronted her sister, Alice gave an elated smile and triumphantly proclaimed that they were now gone. Julie lay awake that night, listening to Alice frantically pacing up and down the flat and whispering to herself. She barely slept at all now. As much as she loved Alice, Julia began to feel a gnawing pang of dread and even resentment towards her sister. The situation was out of her control. The next morning, she dialed a number she never wanted to dial and had a conversation she never wanted to have. After hanging up, Julie called in sick to work. She wanted to be there when they came for Alice. Alice was still asleep when Julie flicked on the kettle. Realizing she had no milk, she threw a coat over her pajamas and went to the corner shop. She'd been gone 10, maybe 15 minutes. She recalled the keys jingling as she turned them in the lock and pushed open the front door, which opened onto the living room. This was followed by a dull, wet thud as she dropped the carton of milk. Shards of glass and bits of plastic littered the parquet floor. Julie's TV and stereo were smashed beyond repair. She tore through the flat, calling out for her sister. But Alice was nowhere to be found. Julie grabbed her phone and made a frantic call to the police. It didn't take long to find Alice. What was left of her, anyway? According to the CCTV footage, she had exited the flat shortly after Julie, turning left where her sister took a right moments before, and walked to the tube station on Clapham High Street, where she waited calmly on the platform before hurling herself in front of an oncoming train. Julie threw down a cigarette butt, stubbing it out with a steel-toe capped boot, and shivered. The coroner's inquest declared that Alice's suicide had been caused by a dissociative episode triggered by stress. Considering her medical history, it wasn't a massive stretch for them to reach that conclusion. I told her I was sorry I asked. She shrugged and said she'd learned to live with it. Like everyone else, Julie used the joke about the curse. Now, she just made a point of leaving the room when a conversation turned towards karaoke. By then, Julie looked like she was on the verge of tears. But I couldn't leave it alone. I asked her what song Alice sang that night. She actually laughed at this. Alice had sung "Can't Stand Losing You." The irony clearly wasn't lost on her. I thanked Julie for the cigarette and went back inside, now very sober by our conversation. We didn't talk again for the rest of the night and eventually headed our separate ways. I should have let it go after that, and I never bothered Julie about it again. There just seemed to be more to the story, like an itch I needed to scratch. Further research led me to some old tabloid clippings about the fire in Soho, a few forum posts, and an old Angel Fire site on urban myths. The site included a link to a Japanese article about an incident at a bar in Kabukicho in 1973. Since I don't speak Japanese, and machine translation proved less than illuminating, I threw my findings together in a short article that Jez approved and posted to the site. It got decent traction, but nothing groundbreaking. Figuring I'd wasted enough time, I was ready to move on after that. Then an envelope arrived on my desk. There was no stamp or postmark, and it arrived with the rest of the morning post. It contained a flyer for a karaoke night at a pub in Kilburn. I wouldn't have paid any mind to it until I read the handwritten note scrawled at the bottom. Follow Alice down the rabbit hole. No need for the police. I had never mentioned Alice or her story in my article. I decided not to tell Julie about the flyer. She made a point of avoiding me since that night in the pub. Any communication we had now was through tersely worded emails. Besides, the words Julie Connell and Practical Joker don't exactly mesh. I did show the flyer to Jez, who grumbled that I'd better things to do than traipse around boozers in Kilburn on a Tuesday night. It may say something about my personal life, but I really didn't have anything better to do. So, that was exactly what I did. It was already getting dark when I exited the underground. it had begun to drizzle and a chilly mist closed around me like a fist as I began to make my way up Kilburn High Road. It didn't take long to find the place. The bar sat in an alley off the main thoroughfare. The dingy sign above read, "The Borough Inn." I was greeted by ambient, lo-fi music that hummed through the narrow front bar. I bought a drink and spotted the staircase leading to the basement, illuminated by a dim orange glow from the overhead lights. The music transitioned to acid house as I descended the steps. This area was larger, complete with a stage and dance floor flanked by red lacquered tables. I placed my drink on a vacant table and scanned the room. There were 9 people in total. Most of them looked like the remnants of after-work drinks or regulars with nowhere else to be. The atmosphere was more Soundgarden than Savage Garden. I sipped my soda and lime, momentarily lost in my thoughts. So lost, in fact, that I didn't notice when the man in the grey suit appeared on the stage. He was crouched forward, checking some unseen piece of equipment behind him. He then stood to his feet and turned. He was very tall and pale, with dark hair greased into a pompadour. His suit was made from a sateen-like fabric, with wide, boxy shoulders that swamped his narrow frame. There was something oddly brittle about him, like something that had been melted down and recast over and over until all that remained was a pale imitation of a man. The hairs on the back of my neck rose as he introduced himself to the small crowd as the MC. Contrary to what you may think, I had not planned to go near that stage. First of all, any singing that I do takes place in the confines of my shower, and secondly, as a journalist, my job was only to observe. But something drew me towards that stage, and the outstretched hand of that MC. I noticed his fingernails were long and yellow as he pulled me onto the platform. Nobody else paid us any attention. At the time, I thought it was just a big city indifference. Now, I'm not sure if something else was at play. I cast about, trying to locate the screen where I could select my song. The MC shook his head and let out a high-pitched giggle. I was taken aback at how shrill it was. He flashed a vulpine smile and pointed to a small white box with various knobs and dials. Big black letters on the front read, "Duke 8. It looked old. At the base of the box was a thick slot for an 8-track player. To the right of the slot was a small hollow. I shot the MC a look of confusion. He contorted his features in feigned exasperation before handing me a strange coin. There was an image of a mountain on one side and the number 100 etched under the reverse. He nodded towards the white box. Sure enough, there was a thin slit at the top. I followed the MC's lead and popped the coin in the slot. The machine whirred to life and the lights at the bottom flashed red. A loud ka-thunk sounded and a heavy 8-track cassette dropped into the vacant aperture. The MC picked up the cartridge and inserted it into the player before thrusting the microphone into my hand. He then twirled a delicate wrist in a circular motion, indicating that I should turn and face the audience. I was about to ask how I was supposed to read the lyrics. I shouldn't have worried. My breath caught in my throat as soon as I heard the song. A song I knew by heart, but desperately wanted to forget. I held the microphone to my lips as the music resonated from every corner of the room. Far too high definition for the 8-track's looping stereo. My tongue suddenly felt too big for my mouth. I closed my eyes, the familiar notes dredging up a pain that I kept submerged for years. I hit my cue and started to sing. I thought of my mother. She'd fallen into a coma at the end of her illness. I suppose it was a small mercy that she was allowed to spend her last remaining weeks at home. The only thing that remained intact was her hearing. That wasn't much comfort to a surely 13-year-old, I'd say things in a desperate attempt to shock her awake, like Dad was getting me a Vespa for Christmas, or that I dropped out of school to campaign for UKIP. I would have given anything for some kind of reaction, just to know she was still there. One morning, a parcel arrived. It was a CD mix of Mum's favourite songs that my uncle had put together. I slapped the CD on, and I recognised the first song immediately. In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel. The first film her and Dad ever saw together was Say Anything, and the soundtrack had blared from a Ford Fiesta every day when she picked me up from school. The emotion was too much for Dad. He got choked up and had to leave the room for fear of bursting into tears. That was a pity, because he missed the most extraordinary thing. Mum started to move ahead to the music. They were just small, fragile nods, but there was a rhythm to them. To me, it was everything. It meant that she was still connected to this world, that she could hear us, and she knew she wasn't alone. My mother died 2 days later. I think that's what ignited my passion for music, knowing the power that a few chords can have to pull you together or completely rip you apart. My eyes stung with tears as I opened them again. I wish I hadn't. The bar had vanished, along with the people. In their place was a room bathed in hues of blue and violet neon. The dance floor and PVC tables were replaced with dark wooden tables and soft leather stools, each topped with a small lamp and tasseled pink lampshade. A soft flurry fell from above. Was it snowing inside? I expected the snowflakes that landed on my hand to be cold. Instead, it was warm, and the colour of soot. I craned my neck upwards, and my mouth hung open in disbelief. There was no ceiling. All that remained was a jagged moor of blackened roof beams that opened onto a starless night sky. My attention turned back to the interior as a hideous smell permeated my nostrils, a discordant mix of damp earth and the meaty aroma of grilled bacon. I saw them then. Dozens of people faced the stage. Most of them were naked, with burnt and peeling skin that revealed patches of white bone. Some stood at tufts of sizzled hair in places. Only the ghostly spectators at the front wore clothes. One man stood in a pair of pyjamas, his neck ringed with purple ligature marks. One girl swayed to the music. The right side of her face was a tattered ruin. Another wore a wet, velour tracksuit, her pale, bloated face lined with purplish veins. All had milky, irisless eyes that were fixed on me. I heard a small cough. The MC was casually leaning against the adjacent wall, looking on with a frank disinterest. His quiff was flecked with ash that had begun to accumulate on the wide shoulders of his suit. He made a circular, wrap-it-up motion with a gnarled index finger. I realised I'd stopped singing. Wanting to be free of this nightmare, I uttered the next lyric. Love, I don't like to see so much pain, so much wasted, and this moment keeps slipping away. My voice cracked at the bridge, and all my instincts, they return, and the grand facade so soon will burn. Members of the macabre audience contorted their bodies in awkward, jerky motions as they began to dance. I shut my eyes. In your eyes, I see the light, the heat. Some let out rasping moans and howls of approval. My voice became a whisper. Oh, I want that to be complete. The dreadful shrieks grew louder. The resolution of all the fruitless searches. The feverish cacophony continued until it reached an ear-splitting decibel. I couldn't take it anymore. I closed my eyes and screamed at the top of my lungs. Stop! Please stop! The next thing I felt was a hammy hand on my shoulder. You're right, mate. I open my eyes to see the confused face of the barman staring back at me. I was alone on the stage. The MC and his flock of lost souls were nowhere to be seen. I wish I could say that there was an end of my experience, that I could chalk all of this up to an overwrought mind. But ever since that night, I've been experiencing some very strange things. They were small at first, like the sensation of fingertips grazing my skin, or the constant hiss of static when I turn on the TV or radio. Lately, it's become more pronounced. Like the last time I took a shower. I've tried to convince myself that I slipped, but I can't explain the blinding pain that made me topple onto the tiles, like something had connected sharply with my temple, like the knuckles of a closed fist. I haven't showered in a few days, and I'm avoiding changing my clothes. I can feel those invisible hands on me if I stay covered up. Today, I caught my reflection in the blank TV screen. The ragged outline of a man stood behind me, its pale eyes boring into mine. I live alone, and I can't go outside now. I'm sending you a warning while I can. If things ever go back to normal, please be careful when singing karaoke in London. The songs are just a conduit. It's the singers that are cursed.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.